Thank you very much, Rabbi Miller, and good evening to you all. What is the purpose of this text, of this beautiful story? If you look at the source that you can find in the first passage on your page, number one, this is the classic statement in the Talmud. Actually, it occurs in the Midrash, Rut Rabbah. Amar Rabbi Zeira, Megillazu ein ba lo tum'a v'lo tahara. This book doesn't have in it laws of impurity and purity. It doesn't teach you what's forbidden and what's permitted. Why was it written? That's the question. Lama nichtava, the reason for the text. Lelamedcha kama sachar tov legomlei chasadim, to teach you how much good reward there is for those who do loving kindness, for those who act in loving kindness. It's a story that tells you about what good things happen to good people. Now, if I put it like that, that sounds really very bland. Good things happening to good people, really, do we need a book in Tanakh to teach us about that? However, that expression, gomlei chasadim, those who deal in chesed. Now, I don't know how many people here have a sense of the word chesed. Can I have a sense of some nods of the head? Does the word chesed mean something to you? I see, yes. The word chesed, what shall I say? It's hard to translate. The usual translation is loving kindness. People who are kind, people who deal in love, this would be the Hebrew word for that area of human experience. And if I try to think in the book of Ruth, who are the people who deal in chesed and who are rewarded for it, then I think, who should I think about? Well, perhaps the way Boaz behaves to Ruth in the field. Classic acts of chesed. Acts of chesed that are actually commanded in the Torah. In the book of Deuteronomy, in Sefer Dvarim, you have the laws of how you should behave if a poor person comes to your field, if a widow comes into your society, if a proselyte comes into your society. And here we have a woman turning up at the beginning of this book who fills all three of those categories. She's a widow, she's poor, and she is an outsider. She's a proselyte. And Boaz does to her as the Torah says one should do to such vulnerable people. He leaves for her the gleanings in the field. He leaves the corner unreaped, so that ungathered, so that she can come and take what she needs. He does classically everything that has to be done in such a situation, and he becomes an exemplar thereby of chesed. And look what a good thing happens to him, that he gets to marry Ruth. Well, I don't know about that, but at any rate, King David, as Rabbi Miller mentioned, King David comes of that marriage, and eventually the Messianic line. The Messiah himself will come of that marriage. Look what good things happen to good people. That would be one very obvious example, very practical example of chesed. I have no argument with that. However, is that really what the book is about? Is the book about the chesed of Boaz to Ruth in the field? I'm not so sure. If that's what the book is about, it's only partially. What else is chesed in the book? Where else can we find chesed in this book? Well, I might say how Ruth is to her mother-in-law. What Ruth does to her mother-in-law, that she refuses to abandon her, that she insists on going with her, accompanying her to the end of the journey, to a place that she never knew. Everyone knows that that's really what the plot is about. And that is, of course, an act of chesed. And look what good things happened to Ruth. However, I think there's more to it than that. And when we begin to look at the more to it, then it will become harder to translate chesed as simply kindness. It will become clearer that there's something more in chesed than is covered by that very nice English word, kindness. The English word kindness I'm in no way disparaging. It's a rich word in English. It has something to do in its origin, in its Anglo-Saxon origin, it has to do with something that is deeply natural to a human being. But the Hebrew resonances of the word chesed are different. And I'd like to explore what are those resonances. What is this book really about? I think it's about a love story. This book is a love story. It's become fashionable recently in the last few years to say that the real love story of the book of Ruth is the love between Ruth and Naomi. I don't know if you've read material, you've read articles that make that claim. Forget the love story between Ruth and Boaz. The real love story is between Naomi and Ruth, and Ruth's statement of devotion to Naomi, and so forth. I wanted to go back to the classical understanding. The classical understanding is that the real love story is between Ruth and Boaz. There is something that happens between Ruth and Boaz that's called chesed. That's essentially what I want to say. It's called chesed, and therefore it has to do with love, not just in the sense of kindness, not in the simple sense of kindness. One of the most extraordinary places where you find the word chesed in this book It's on that night in the granary. You remember the story? Does everyone know the story? Where Ruth turns up during the night after the end of the harvest, and she basically claims Boaz as her husband. She basically says, this is who I am, and this is what you're going to do. We'll come to it in detail. And he says to her, very strikingly, Heitavt chasdech ha'charon min harishon. Your latter chesed, your latest chesed, is better than your former chesed. Bilti lechet achareya bachurim im dal im rash. That you didn't go after young men, whether poor or rich, but you came after me. You came to marry me rather than going, you could have had anyone, he says to her. Now, the first thing I would say about that is, isn't he being rather courteous here? Isn't he being rather gallant to her? She could have had anyone. Is that really so clear that she could have had anyone she wanted? She's a poor, underprivileged, apparently underprivileged outsider. But what he says to her represents a kind of exquisite courtesy. He says to her from the heart, what you've just done to me represents the best form of chesed. This chesed that you've done in claiming me as your husband, this is better than your former chesed, your famous chesed, the chesed that everyone will remember about you, how you behaved to Naomi, the fact that you wouldn't abandon Naomi, that pales in comparison with the way what you've just done here. And one wonders, what is the chesed that she has just done to him? After all, he has everything to give her. He is the rich man, she is the poor girl. It's a classic beggar-prince situation. And he is telling her, and I think it's not just gallantry, he's describing something real. He's saying to her, this was true chesed, what happened at this moment. The Midrash comments on this strange statement by Boaz and says that women, makes a general statement about women. Right? One doesn't necessarily always love general statements about women, but this one at least is comic. If not more than that. That women generally prefer a rich man, prefer a rich old man. I'm sorry. I'm a little confused. Put it down to jet lag or to California or something. Women generally prefer a poor young man to a rich old man. That is, there's something in the nature of women will always lalechet acharei, the expression is used here again, to go after, to follow. That's the expression that he uses to her, that you went after, instead of going after young people, you came after me. It's natural in a woman to go after poor young men rather than rich old men. I think that's rather comic, perhaps, in the Californian context. Perhaps that's what somewhat misled me. And therefore, she gets credit. He gives her credit for not doing the banal thing, for not doing the thing that every young woman would want to do, and instead doing something unusual, going after someone who is older and coming to claim him. And he calls that chesed, as if she has in her hand a gift, and there is a gift that she has just bestowed upon him. And what he's talking about here, I think, is not quite as obvious as it seems at first. One could be very almost crude about it to say what he's thanking her for. But I think what he's thanking her for is more subtle than may at first appear. He's acknowledging a basic chesed, which is counterintuitive to our understanding of the situation. You look at the situation, it's clear that he is the one who's doing chesed to her in this situation. There's a classic statement about chesed in the prophet Jeremiah. This is a verse that is very famous. Everyone knows it, I think. Zecherti lach chesed neuraich. I remember to you, and God says this to the Jewish people through Jeremiah the prophet, I remember to you, for your credit, the love of your youth. Chesed ne'urayich, the chesed of your youth, ahavat klulotayich, the love of your betrothal period. What was that love that I remember to you? Lechtech acharai bamidbar be'eretz lo zrua. The fact that you went after me, there's that expression again, lalechet acharei. It often seems to occur, especially in the book of Ruth, in connection with the idea of chesed. What is it to act in chesed? It has something to do with go after. What does God remember to the Jewish people, to their credit? The fact that you went after me into the desert, into an unsown land. Lechtech acharai bamidbar be'eretz lo zrua. That was what you did in your youth, in your betrothal period with me, as it were, that you were willing to follow me into the unknown, to follow me out of Egypt into the unknown. Now, the situation in which the people followed God out of Egypt into the unknown, if one thinks back to that situation, after all, again, it wasn't one in which the people seemed to have very much to bestow. The people were impoverished, like Ruth. They were nothing. They were slaves. God took them out of Egypt. God redeemed them from Egypt. God is the one who bestowed chesed on them. That's how the story should be read more normally. That God comes and redeems them with a strong hand, an outstretched arm, and takes them out of Egypt. That's not the way God remembers the story years later. Strangely, God remembers the story after centuries have passed. He remembers that there was something in that relationship, in that original betrothal, that was exactly the opposite of the way a crude outsider would look at it. In the intimacy of the relationship, the chesed went from the poor one to the rich one, from the human beings, from the slaves, towards God. They acted in chesed towards God. If you glance at the source, you can find number two. You find Rashi making his comment on this moment in history. He makes the comment on at the moment of the Exodus, where we read that the people didn't even prepare provisions for themselves when they left Egypt to go out into the desert. But we can't say lo asulahem for the journey. They didn't do the ordinary rational thing of preparing provisions for the journey. This teaches the praise of Israel, that they didn't say, how can we go out into the desert without provisions? But they believed and they went. As we find written in the prophets, and there's a quotation from Jeremiah, I remember to you the chesed of your youth, the love of your betrothal, the fact that you went after me into the desert, into an unknown land. So Rashi is here quoting that verse to describe the situation in which the people leave Egypt without even preparing the necessary provisions, sandwiches, for the next few days. Begam tzeda lo asulahem. Is this madness on their part? No, says Rashi, this is credit. Here we're giving praise to the people. When the Torah says they didn't even prepare provisions, they're being praised. They're being praised for what? For what function? What characteristic? It's called here he'eminu, that they believed. They believed and they went. Belief is somewhere put beside chesed. A function of chesed has a question of belief. Belief in what? Rashi doesn't say in what. They believed that what? Doesn't say they believed that God would give them food. Doesn't say that. He simply says, he'eminu v'alchu. The content of their belief is not spelled out. What particularly it was that they believed, who knows? What we do know is they believed in. They didn't believe that, but they believed in. They believed in God. They believed in the lover. Now, when we say, I believe in you, and someone says to someone else, I believe in you, leave God out of it for the moment. When in a relationship, someone says to someone else, I believe in you, there is in that statement a powerful act of chesed. And that is something that's not obvious. It's an act of imagination. It's an act of avoiding the normal, banal, fearful responses, the cautious, canny way in which we normally act. We put in good insurance, right? We take out good insurance before we go off into a desert, if we have our wits about us. However, if we don't have our wits about us, but we have chesed about us, if we have this mysterious entity that I'm calling chesed, if we have that, then we say mad things like, I believe in you. And then, of course, it depends on how it turns out. Now, then think of the story of the Pied Piper. If we talk about going after, if we talk about following, lelechet acharei, to go after somebody, which is the expression that's used about the Israelites going after God in Jeremiah, and is the expression that's used about Ruth several times, that she goes after Naomi, she insists on going after her, lelechet achareha, at the beginning of the story, and as we just noticed, Boaz says, this is the greatest chesed is that you didn't go after young men, but you came after me. What is it to go after? Well, the paradigm going after is, I think, the Pied Piper. The story of the Pied Piper, where all those children, what shall we say, in an act of blind faith, right? That's an ambiguous expression, blind faith. I think when we use that expression, we betray our ambivalence, our uneasiness on the one hand. What happened to those children? You can regard this as a suicidal project. They follow the Piper, and they disappear forever. Their homes are left empty of children. It's a tragic moment. This moment of blind faith. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, however, those children got, presumably, everything their hearts desired. Whatever they wanted in following the lure of the piper, whatever that the sound of the pipe evoked for them, whatever desire awoke in their hearts when they heard the music of the piper, they found it. They went after it and they found it. And whether the act of faith, the act of chesed, and the connection between the two is my subject this evening. Whatever that comes to mean perhaps has more to do with the hearer than anything else. How does one hear this question of chesed? Does one think of it as craziness, as madness, as suicide? Or does one think of it as something, as a movement into the transcendent, a movement beyond rationality, beyond the obvious? After all, what does Rashi say very simply here? What is the chesed of the people? What they didn't say. Shelo amru. What didn't they say? How can we go out into the desert without food? They didn't say the normal, rational, fearful things that people say. That alone is enough to qualify them for chesed. That is, that now they have, they are being, the compliment they're being given is a compliment that is called chesed and that doesn't mean simply kindness. You can't say that the people were being kind to God. That would be an inappropriate translation. But chesed is the word that's used here. Love is closer, but it's a particular quality of love. And that's what I'd like to explore when we look now into the book of Ruth. Ruth insists on going back to Bethlehem with her mother-in-law. You remember the story. The story begins essentially with death. It begins with the death of three men, the husbands, all three husbands, Naomi's husband, Ruth's husband, and Orpah's husband, the two daughters-in-law also lose their husbands, all die. And the story begins with three widows on the road back to Bethlehem. Naomi tries to persuade her daughters-in-law to leave her, and she keeps on using the expression shovna, go back, return. When she uses the word return, it's very clear and rational and obvious what she means. Go back to where you come from. Go back, not isha lebet ima, each woman to the house of her mother. That makes it very clear. Each woman to her maternal place, the place she came from, her mother place. That means Moab. Or Isha Beit Isha. Not only go back to the past, but go back to your presumed future. You are widows, you have to find a husband. Isha Beit Isha, go back each woman to the house of her future man. You go back to where you will be able to find men for yourselves, and that is in your own culture, in your own place of origin. And she urges them to the natural movement. The natural movement, lashuv, tshuva. What do they say to her? First both say it, and then Orpah drops out. And only Ruth is left saying this. Saying, singing. I almost hear this as a kind of lyric opera. She insists on saying, with great beauty, ki itach nashuv. But with you we want to return. We want to return. She uses the word return in an irrational way. Irrational in the same way as it's irrational to go out into a desert without food. She cannot return. She can't return to Bethlehem. She never was there. It has nothing to do with her. She doesn't have her origin there. She has neither a mother nor a future husband there, as far as she knows. There is nothing for her there, but except this woman in whom she believes. And that means as much or as little as you want it to mean. It means nothing at all, if you will. What do you mean to believe in another woman? But I think that's exactly the way in which we should think of it. That that's all she has to support her. And in terms of that, she uses irrationally the word lashuv. That, in fact, I want to go back with you. She identifies herself so thoroughly with her mother-in-law. It's as if she is returning. It's as if she, too, is returning somewhere. And it's not only by association. She herself feels that she's returning to a place where she's never been. And in the end, the text of the book supports her in this and speaks about her as Ruth HaMoaviyah, Hashava Misde Edom, who has returned from the field of Edom. That is, what we have here is backed up, this text backs her up in this irrational movement back from her own place of origin, back from Moab to the place that in some real sense is hers. It's hers in a real sense, but in a surrealistic sense, in a sense that doesn't belong in this world. That is the first irrational movement in the book. As you remember, Naomi tries to dissuade her in every possible way. And Ruth makes her great declaration of loyalty and fidelity. Your place is my place. Essentially, in every way, your home is my home, your God is my God, and so on. I won't read through that beautiful text at this moment. You notice that there is no cognitive content to that statement. It's not that she's saying, I expect to find there A, B, and C. I expect to find a future husband. I expect to find certain goods. All she is saying is, I believe in you. I want to be with you. And at a certain point, Naomi stops trying to dissuade her. And what we read is, "Vatera Naomi saw ki mit ametzeti lelechetita." That Ruth was insisting, mit ametzet, hit ametz. Interesting word. I could talk at great length about this word. I just want to say one word about it. The word Aleph Mem Tzadik means to be strong. It means to be tensed up somewhere. It means to tense one's muscles. There's actually a commandment in the book of Deuteronomy, Lo te'ametz et levavcha. You shall not clench up your heart against the poor, against the poor person. That is, if a poor person comes to you and asks for help, don't do that very natural thing, that very obvious, uncharitable thing that people do, which is to close up their hearts. It's a very natural movement. It comes very easy. Just to, that clenching of the muscles that says, I am I and you are you. Here we have Ruth, strangely, she is the one who is mit ametzet. She clenches up her heart. She tightens herself to go with her mother-in-law. That is, she resists her mother-in-law's blandishments, her mother-in-law's persuasions. That is, she is not just a nice girl. Let's forget about it, that she's just a nice, kind girl, and whatever anyone says to her, she'll go along. It's the opposite. Naomi is using every weapon in her arsenal to persuade her not to go along, and she is insisting on going along, almost against Naomi's will. There's tremendous strength of character here, and almost a kind of muscular tension. She is not simply, she's not as sticky as she looks. When I say sticky, I mean something very specific. What do we read? Her sister-in-law, Orpah, kissed her mother-in-law goodbye. But Ruth, dovkaba. But Ruth clung to her. And that word, to cling, Ruth is a clinger. And we'll see that again and again. She is someone who's davek. Now, davek means to be sticky. Lidbok. It's the word, devek is the word for glue in modern Hebrew. It means somewhere to be totally attached. So attached as Sartre, Jean-Paul Sartre, has a famous essay on stickiness, viscosity, and the mixture of fascination and repulsion that one has for things that are sticky. Things that are sticky, like honey or glue, if you get your fingers in honey, there's something slightly disgusting about it. Children are very fascinated by watching the honey run off their fingers, and the sense that I'm no longer so clear about what's me and what's not me. Once I have my fingers in something sticky, I begin to be aware that that very, very clear boundary between my body and the world out there is to be compromised. It's not so simple. Things that are liquid run off my fingers easily. Things that are solid, I don't have to get involved in at all. They are they and I am I. Things that are sticky compromise the boundaries. And Ruth is the one who lives on that boundary. She lives in a sticky place where it's no longer so clear who is who and what is what. She's an outsider who insists on being an insider. She's someone from Moab who wants to return to Beit Lechem. But when we say she's sticky, we have to also remember that she's mit ametzet, that she has muscles. She is not a spineless creature. She is someone who has a force, a power of attachment, of knowing how to attach herself to those who are other to her. But there's a force to it. She knows exactly what she's doing. And in fact, what she is showing tremendous power in resisting the power of the dissuasions, the rational dissuasions that Naomi tries to set against her. Who is Ruth, after all? What do we know about her beyond this very minimal story? Very little at all. Where does she come from? She knows she's from Moab. We don't know anything about her until the spotlight suddenly shines on her. The one thing we know about her is what her mother-in-law says to her. And she says, may God pay you good kindness. May God ya'aseh Hashem imachem chesed ka'asher asitem im hametim imadi. May God give you great kindness, great chesed, as you have given to the dead and to me. Implying that the only thing we know about Ruth and Orpah, the two daughters-in-law, is that they demonstrated great chesed to Naomi and her two sons in the past. And we're not given any details about it, but this is the pedigree with which she comes into the story, that chesed accompanied her in her previous life, the life before the story began. And this chesed now continues when she comes into the spotlight, and it continues in unexpected and strange ways. She's an elusive figure. The end of the story, she simply disappears. It's an uncanny ending. She gives birth to a child, and the child is nursed by Naomi, her mother-in-law. Suddenly, Naomi becomes, as it were, wet nurse of her grandchild, and Ruth simply disappears. There's a genealogy given downwards now to King David, and Ruth, as if she has simply tiptoed off stage, as soon as her hour in the light, an hour in the spotlight is over, there's a kind of selflessness which is part of Chesed. Who is she? She is Chesed incarnate. What does that mean? And here we have some surprises. It's not being nice. Beginning of chapter 2, Ruth says to Naomi one day, it seems that they've already been a certain amount of time in the city. She says to Naomi, I want to go and to look for food. I want to go and gather in the field. But she said, Elchana hasadeh, let me go down to the field and let me glean among the sheaves. Achar asher imtzachin be'inav. Behind someone in whose eyes I will find favor. Now that's an interesting expression. Notice achar, that she always thinks of somewhere being behind, of following after. I will find someone to follow. I'll go down into the field and I'll find someone to attach myself to. All right? Here is the Piper motif again. She was first she followed Naomi back into Bethlehem, and now she already imagines that she'll find someone to attach herself to. Now that expression, lalechet acharei, for me the most convincing translation has something to do with entrancement, with fascination, as with the Pied Piper. To go after is to be fascinated by. The person that you choose to go after is a person who occupies your imagination, who takes you over. And she expects to find in the field someone that she'll be able to follow in this way. But what is the dynamic that she imagines? I will find favor in his eyes. Now, that is an interesting agenda for, let's say, a young woman, a young stranger in town, who says that I am sure, think of the way she thinks of her future now, I will go down to the field and I'm sure that I'll find someone there. How do we translate very banally, limtsochen, to find favor? The normal translation is simply to like, right? I'll find someone who will like me. That would be a very banal translation for someone in whose eyes I will find a favor. It seems a rather brazen thing to say, in a sense, right? What she's saying is, with the confidence of presumably an attractive young woman, we'll see as we go on that it's not so obvious at all that she's either attractive or young. We'll see as we go on. She says, I'm sure I'll find someone who will like me and who will allow me to glean in his field. That seems to be the kind of the first translation. However, I think the Hebrew expression limsochen contains in it much more than that. It's to find favor, to find grace in the eyes of somebody. That is, there's a certain confidence that she has that she will find someone who will find in her something that's called chen, who will identify her, who will see her in such a way that he will recognize what's called chen, grace, charm. Grace, charm, chen v'chesed are often used together. The two words, chen and chesed, are often used together. There is something about the relationship between her and, at this point, anonymous person. This is a hypothetical person that she's going to meet in the field. That's called finding favor. I will find favor in his eyes. What happens? She goes down into the field. Boaz comes into the field, asks after her. Who is that? To whom is that girl? And he speaks to her very kindly. He hears who she is. He speaks to her very kindly. Clearly, he is the kind person. He's opening up the resources of his field to her. And she answers him. It's chapter 2, verse 10. She falls on her face and she bows down to the earth and she says to him, Madua matzati chen be'enecha lakireni v'anochi nochria. Why have I found favor in your eyes to single me out? And I am a stranger. A strange woman. What is she saying here? She's bowing down in great humility. And she's saying, why have I found favor in his eyes? What has she just done when she said that? She's pointed out to him, I found favor in your eyes. In case he hasn't noticed it, and in many cases, I think, people don't notice. Right? Not to say men don't notice, that's what I really mean. That is, something has happened here that he could perhaps account for as simple, he's done his duty by a poor stranger widow. But she is pointing out to him that something has happened between them. And she's saying, I found favor in your eyes. And she puts it with extreme humility. She bows down and says, why have I found favor in your eyes? I am, after all, a mere stranger. And when she says, I'm a stranger, which is really unnecessary, she doesn't have to say that. Why have I found favor in your eyes is really quite sufficient. She's actually talking about a certain kind of knowledge. Lahakir and Nochriya, to single me out. Why have you singled me out and I am a stranger? Who does one single out, after all, if not the stranger? It's someone who comes with a different kind of appeal. Someone who comes and presents herself. I have a beautiful sentence here from the French philosopher Edmond Jabez. The foreigner, stranger, allows you to be yourself by making a foreigner of you. There's a certain access that she opens up in Boaz's mind to his true self. To his, not his official, important, princely, powerful, rich self, but something else that suddenly she opens up to him, right? Through the fact that she's a stranger, and she approaches him with a certain level of equality, a certain level of metziat chen. Something happens between them, and she points it out here. She says, why? Why has this happened? And the effect of her reminder here, of her drawing attention to this moment, the effect is that he then speaks to her in a different tone. And he speaks to her now in a tone of very profound recognition. It's not just he singled her out, but he knows her as a first-level knowledge. Yep, Boaz answered her and he said to her, Huged Hugadli, I've been told all about you. I've heard everything you did with your mother-in-law, all the chesed that you did to her, how you left your father and mother and the land of your birth, and you went to a people that you didn't know yesterday or the day before. He tells her her own story. Now, telling her own story, to tell a stranger her own story, is probably the most poignant act of loving kindness that a person can do. A stranger comes to town and suffers from all the disabilities of being strange, of being not part of this world, of this society. And an insider, a powerful insider, doesn't just give her wheat in the field, doesn't just give her the resources of his field, but actually tells her, I've heard all about you. Gives her a place within his culture, takes her into his culture, and describes her essentially with the same words that I used to describe Abraham in the great Lech Lecha moment, the beginning of the story of Abraham, that he left his land and his birthplace and the house of his father, and he uses the same idioms in talking about Ruth and saying, I know to your credit what you've done for the sake of your mother-in-law. And he speaks to her now in a tone of profound acknowledgement, profound spiritual acknowledgement. And it's a tone of acceptance and of blurring the boundaries between them. It's a tone of chesed. Where does it come from? The paradox is that tone and that full expression of chesed on his part comes from her chesed. It's generated by her, by the things she has said to him, madua matzatichin. The way she has spoken to him about finding favor in your eyes is what makes him aware now of the current of chesed that runs between them. And it begins to run now in a circular way between the two of them. What else is between the two of them? Well, it's very simple. In Chazal, the sages say it very simply. He uses a strange expression to her. He says, stick to my girls. The chotid bakin, that same expression. Davik. Stick to my girl servants when you are reaping in the field. And the sages ask, why does he use that rather strange and rather sexual expression? They hear in that a sexuality, the word davik. It comes from the original description of how a man will marry a woman at the beginning of the book of Genesis. V'davak b'ishto. Therefore, a man will leave his father and his mother, and he will cling to his wife. V'davak b'ishto. Davak is the word that's used back then. He uses that expression to her. Why does he use that rather indelicate expression? All right, he's talking about sticking with the girl servants. But Chazal, the sages, take this as a kind of Freudian slip in a very serious way. That he uses that kind of language because that he already knows that will be his relation to her. That already there is that erotic component in the relationship. He also, when she says to him, Lahakireni, why have you found, I found favor in your eyes to recognize me, Lahakireni, to know me. The sages again say that she's prophesying. She's saying to him, the day will come when you will know me, when you will fully know me. And so what we have here, if one is very sensitive, one has one's antennae up to this first conversation, is the beginning of a relationship, and the beginning is created by Ruth. Ruth has the power to create and form the relationship between herself and Boaz, poor and outsider and widow as she is, she has a certain power which creates the very beginning of a relationship which is to be so powerful, which in the end will produce King David himself. It has an erotic component to it, and that is all the more credit to Ruth. After all, where does Ruth come from? And here we come to the heart of what I really would like to suggest this evening. Ruth, as you know, comes from Moab, and Moab has a very sorry history. Where does Moab come from? Moab comes from an incestuous relationship between a young woman and her father, right? The story of Lot and his two daughters, who after the destruction of Sodom, find themselves in a cave of all places. They regress into a cave, and one after the other, the two daughters have relations with their father in order that the world should continue. They think that the world has come to an end. The one who is more brazen about it is the one who calls her son, actually, Me'avi, Moav, from my father. That's the Midrashic understanding of the word Moav. And so in the very name of her nation, Ruth carries a certain history of, how shall we say, indelicacy. The word that's used in Hebrew is znut. That is a certain lasciviousness, which seems to be the characteristic of that nation. There are other stories that one could speak about. The temptation of the Moabite girls in the desert, if you remember. Moab is known for this. And here comes Ruth and modulates that basic melody of her nation into something very different, from being indelicate into something delicate and generative, something in which a respectful and a tender relationship can be built. And she does it through her use of words, through the way in which she suggests to Boaz the very essence of chesed. And I'm coming closer now to a definition of chesed. There's something about what happens in the field when Ruth comes back at the end of the day to her mother-in-law, and her mother-in-law asks her, "Where, in whose field did you act today?" She answers with great self-confidence. You can see the verse quoted in the Midrash in number three. Ha'ish asher asiti emo hayom, the man with whom I did today, the man with whom I acted today. The Midrash comments, she doesn't say the man who acted with me. In other words, the man who was good to me, the man who gave me core of wheat and gleanings to bring home, the man who did good to me, the man with whom I did. What does she mean by saying that? She says, many actions and many good deeds I did with him in return for one piece of bread that he gave me. She has considerable self-confidence, this young woman. What he gave me was food. What I gave him is much more than that. What I gave him, it can't compare to what he gave me. She is very aware of what she has begun to create on that day in the field. And that confidence is based on a singular absence. And here is, in terms of the language of the Book of Ruth, the most striking feature that I am aware of. It's something that I became aware of a few years ago, and I find it endlessly fascinating. In this book, there is one very common, it's like one of the few basic words in the biblical diction that is missing in this book. It's one of the few words you expect to find in any biblical text. There are certain basic words, to come and to go and to sit and to stand and to say. There are certain, your basic glossary. One of those words is signally missing, conspicuously missing from this book. And that's the word lirot, the word to see. In a certain sense, nobody sees anybody else. Of course you have references like, I will find favor in your eyes. That's a reference to the eyes. But that's not the same as seeing. To see someone, well, you would think that would be the essential phase in a love story. In a love story, what happens between Jacob and Rachel, for instance? Jacob comes there to the well, and Rachel turns up at the well, it was when Jacob saw Rachel that he popped the stone off the well with the greatest of ease. He saw her, and clearly that moment of seeing her means he falls in love with her. She's very beautiful. We're told in every possible way that she's very beautiful. And that would be a classic description, a biblical description, of the meeting of the two who are to become husband and wife. In the case of the story of Ruth, there is no seeing. Nobody sees anybody else. If anybody sees, it's that Ruth sees Boaz, but the word to see isn't used. All we read is, behold, Boaz came into the field. So clearly that's from Ruth's point of view, that she registers that Boaz has come into the field. But the word to see is actually not used at all. What else can we say, which I think goes along with this? Ruth is never called beautiful. Now, one might say she could have been beautiful without being called beautiful, but it's really a kind of betrayal of convention. The convention is that when you have the heroine of a biblical story, she's always beautiful, and she's always called beautiful. That's the way it is in many folk stories and myths and so forth, and it's also true of biblical stories. By and large, heroines are beautiful. Ruth is not called beautiful. What are we to think? Are we to think that she wasn't beautiful? I don't think we're to think she's beautiful or not beautiful. I think we're to think that that's not what the story is about. The story is not about beauty. Or perhaps the story is all about beauty. What I really want to say is that the story is all about beauty. It's so centrally about beauty that the expression, yifat toar v'yifat mar'eh, beautiful, beautiful, the usual expressions for beauty, simply wouldn't do. They would be too banal to meet with the intensity on the importance of the beauty experience which this book is about. I think Rabbi Miller began by saying that this is the most beautiful book. Where does this beauty come from? What I want to suggest is the beauty is here, the beauty of a woman who is not called beautiful, who may be 40 years old, according to the Midrash. Right. Horrors. How can one have them? I remember the years, those happy years when I used to think that the age 40 was, you know, nothing interesting could ever happen to anyone at such an age. This book is about a woman who is beyond her first youth, according to this tradition, who is not called beautiful. And I'm suggesting that it's a book about beauty. It's about a woman who creates, who is a subject rather than an object of beauty. It's a woman who creates, through her way of speaking, through her way of behaving, creates an experience of beauty for Boaz and for the relationship between them. One of the very beautiful expressions, places where the word chesed is used, and I want to translate chesed as beauty. That's really going to be my project. One of the places where we find that is in one of the songs, the poems, the piyutim, that we say on Yom Kippur, in the afternoon, in Musaf. We talk in the poem called Mare Kohen. What did the high priest look like when he came safe at the end of the day out of the Holy of Holies, when he emerged from the sacred place? And there's a series of surrealistic images, of extraordinary images, to describe what he looked like. And one of those images says, "Kachesed hanitan al pnei chatan," like the chesed that you find on the face of a bridegroom. What is the chesed that you'll find on the face of a bridegroom? What is chesed? Is it kindness? Not really adequate. Is it love? Yes, but I think it's more than that. The chesed, I think there's no English word for it. The only word I can use is beauty. That there's a certain grace, there's something transcendent that's on the face of the bridegroom and of the bride. Bride and groom share this chesed, that you can see palpably. Now, you can only see it if you're not looking. That's really what I want to say. There's no looking in the Book of Ruth, because if you look in the way people look, in the imperialistic way that people look when they're sizing each other up, when they're looking for opportunities, when they're looking to grade other people, then you will never see this chesed. Then this beauty will elude you. There is a way of looking that happens when you're looking a bit to the side, when you're not staring at the other person and trying to work out what you can know about them, but rather acknowledging that the other person is an ochriya, that the other person is a stranger. The other person is a stranger. There's a great unknown in the presence of the other person. And there's a great unknown, and there's a great beauty about that unknownness. One wants to know, and one knows one won't know by staring. One won't know by looking hard at the other person. I sometimes have this experience very personally, I would have to say, in talking to people, when I'm very interested in what someone's saying, and it's very intense. Someone's talking to me, and it's very intense, and I'm really listening, then I will not look at them. Or I will look just slightly to the side so that I can really concentrate. And it doesn't mean I'm not interested in how they look. I'm almost too interested in how they look. But there is a sense of needing to focus in some way. Now, of course, that notion of not looking, and what I want to look at now with you very briefly, is the dark night in which there is no looking, in which Ruth and Boaz finally make their pact. She comes to him in the darkness of the night. But that relationship that's based on not looking is, of course, the basic mode of a psychoanalytic relationship. It's in that mode that an analyst and a patient know each other. The patient lies in such a way that she cannot, he, she cannot see the analyst, and the analyst cannot see him, her. And Freud actually made a point of it, that was essential to this mode of knowing. He talks about blinding himself artificially, to blind oneself artificially so as to focus the light. Let me see if I can find the... Yes, I blind myself artificially to focus all the light on one dark spot. If what I'm interested in is not the person's nose and eyes and mouth, but rather their unconscious, if I'm interested in knowing something about the darkness within them, in what is unknown even to them, then I blind myself artificially. I try somewhere to focus all my light on what is unknown, what is dark about the other person. What happens, incidentally, it occurs to me, one of the other great psychoanalysts, Wilfred Bion, one of the great English analysts, says that the one thing that the analyst needs to do in his encounter with a patient is to put aside memory and desire. With every encounter with a patient, to leave outside the room, memory and desire, to remember nothing about the patient, not to know anything from the last session or the session before, unless it comes up again in some form, and to have no desires, not even the desire to heal the patient. Even that can be a distraction from the essential act, which is a profound kind of knowing, which can best be done in a certain kind of darkness. What happens on that dark night between Boaz and Ruth? Let me try to say one or two things about it in the very short time we have left. This, of course, is Naomi's idea. Naomi sends Ruth down to the granary floor at the end of the harvest and says to her, and it's very striking the way she puts it, she says, "V'rachatz v'sacht v'samtzim lotech." You should wash yourself, bathe yourself, perfume yourself, and put on your garment. It sounds as if she only has one garment to wear. Put on your dress. The sages say, this teaches you that every person should have two sets of clothes. Now you know. You should have two sets of clothes, one for the weekday and one for Shabbat. And what she is telling Ruth is, put on your Shabbos clothes. Put on, in other words, a certain altered state of consciousness. This will not be your weekday self. This will be your transcendent self. This will be that other part of you that will now go down into this. This will not be the most vulgar part of you. The other part of you will go down in this dangerous project, this obviously indelicate project, which has about it so many associations. After all, granary floors are notoriously, granary floors at the end of a harvest, these are notoriously the places for shenanigans, for all kinds of sexual activities. And Naomi is sending Ruth, in order that she should find peace and rest and goodness, she's sending her into that dangerous place. She's sending her to act the harlot, you might say, but with exactly the opposite intention, with the intention that she should take her Shabbos clothes, she should put onto herself a certain dignity, and to go down and confront something that she can confront only there. What do we then read? We read the words, v'samt, v'yaradit, v'shachab, you will put on your clothes, you'll go down, and you will lie down at his feet. The interesting thing is that in the text, it's written with what's known as a kriyan ktiv. That means that it's read, you shall go down, but it's written, strangely, I shall. I shall get dressed, and I shall go down, and I shall lie down. V'yaradati, v'shachavti. Now, it may be that this is a form of ancient biblical Hebrew, and it actually just means you shall go down. However, if we read it with modern eyes, it looks strange. What is Naomi actually saying to Ruth? The sages put it like this, my merit will go with you. Right? That's a rather pontificating way of putting it. I'd rather put it this way. Naomi is saying to Ruth, when you go down, I go down with you. When you go down, you take me with you. Through no miracle, we're not talking about any form of the supernatural. It's simply the way in which people get mixed up with each other. People who are in a mode of chesed, who know about chesed, get mixed up with each other. Ruth is no longer just Ruth. Ruth is a Naomi Ruth. Ruth will take something of Naomi down with her when she goes into this very hazardous mission. Can she play it right? Can she do it right? She goes and she lies down there at his feet. And here we come to the heart of the story. The man, Boaz, who has gone to sleep feeling very happy, Vaitav Libo. His heart has been, in some way, he's been feeling transcendent. He's been feeling very satisfied. He suddenly wakes up. And what do we read? It was at midnight. The man shuddered and he was gripped about. Now that's a most unusual word. I think it's the only time it occurs in the whole of Tanakh. Vayilafet. It's a hapaxlegomenon. Vayilafet, he was gripped about. She's holding tight onto him. And the sages comment, the Midrash comments here, Lipafto kechazazit. What an image. She twined herself around him like lichen. Am I pronouncing it right? L-I-C-H-E-N. Yes. Like ivy. That is, she grips, here she is, Davik. She is literally, she is holding onto him very tight. And he wakes up and he shudders. Vayecharad. He shudders in fear. That is, there's a danger about these granary floors. Who knows what demons haunt granary floors? His first impression of Ruth, as he comes out of the unconscious, he comes out of unconsciousness, is that she's some kind of dangerous demonic figure, perhaps Lilith, some kind of Lilith figure. And that is the way the Midrash understands this moment. There's a terror in this moment in darkness, this moment where consciousness has been left behind. And then he realizes there's a woman lying at his feet. It's not a demon. It's actually a woman. And gradually, he begins to discern something of what she is. But he speaks to her then, and he says, Mi'at, who are you? Who are you? He wants some kind of clear definition. He wants her to define herself, who she is. Somewhere to escape the hazards of the dark, to escape the shadowy unreality of the dark. And she answers very clearly, but in a way that is not simply a question of daylight, direct clarity. She says, Anochi Rut Amatecha, Ufarasta Knafecha Alamatecha, Ki Goel Ata. I am Ruth, your maidservant, and you shall spread your wing, your kanaf, you shall spread your skirt, your wing, your skirt, over your maidservant, for you are the redeemer. For you are the one who is going to redeem me, who is going to, and she claims him in marriage. Now, the way she puts it, I think we should hear it, we should listen carefully to it. He can't see her, you remember, he only hears her. He hears her, and he hears her with the depth that one hears when one can't see. Because he can't see, he listens to her, and he hears the power of what she's saying. I am, and this is what you will do. She doesn't ask him. She doesn't say, please do this. She simply says to him, because of who I am, Anochi Rut, and she's very modest about it. I am Rut, your maidservant. She doesn't speak with conscious pride, but there's a great clarity to it. I am Ruth, and you will. You will spread your wing, your skirt, sexual, but it also relates to the compliment he gave her earlier on about how she came to take shelter under the wings of the prayer of God. That is, she says to him, you are, on the one hand, you are my sexual partner. You are the one who will protect me sexually. You are the one who will marry me. And you are also aligned with God for me. You are God in my life. I know through you, through my experience of you, I know about God in this world, and that is the experience of chesed. Through you, I know about chesed. I know about protection and about a certain kind of beauty. And he answers her. You might think there could be many possible answers to this. In the daylight, there might have been many answers to this. What do you think you're doing? And how dare you come and exploit me? And I haven't decided yet. And who's making this decision anyway? And so forth. She clearly has made the decision here. How does he answer her? He answers her in the words that we noticed before. By Yomer, he says, Brucha at la Hashem biti, blessed be you to God, my daughter. Heitavt chastech acharon min harishvan. Your latter chesed is better than your former chesed, that you didn't go after young men, whether rich or poor. So he thanks her for coming after him. Lalechet acharei. He thanks her for attaching herself to him in this way. And he calls this the greatest chesed. What has she just done? She has created for him an experience, a compelling experience of chesed, which I suggest is beauty. That the way she speaks, the way she presents herself, gives him access to a possibility of beauty, to a possibility that he is willing now to go after. But hers is the courage. She is the one who's had the courage to do this in a situation that could be interpreted. Imagine how the tabloids, yes, would interpret this situation. The obvious meanings of this situation are the opposite of chesed. They are the opposite. They are lasciviousness and selfishness and ambition and neediness. And she has somehow transmuted, without completely, she hasn't, these themes are there, but she has transmuted them into a mode whereby he can sense that he's attaching himself, in her, he's attaching himself to a beauty which is a beginning, a beauty which is a beginning of a new kind of greatness. Now, what has been achieved here in the darkness is memorably, I think really extraordinarily, celebrated in a midrash that I want to share with you at this point. If you glance at the midrash, you can find in number 4 on your page. What comes of this moment, and what was the meaning of this moment of chesed? Vayehi b'chatzi halayla. It was in the middle of the night. That's when this happened. That's how the story is introduced. This reminds you of another verse in Psalms where King David says, in the middle of the night I will rise up to give thanks to you. You remember King David? That was his hour. King David's special time was midnight. That was when he would wake up, and that's when he would play his harp, and he would give thanks to God. What is his affinity to midnight? Why is it that he likes midnight so much? Well, you might have many answers to that. Here is the midrashic answer. So said David, I have to rise up at midnight to give thanks to you for what you did for my grandfather and grandmother in the middle of the night. As it says, and it was in the middle of the night, and the man shuddered, and he was gripped about. The man was held tight suddenly. He was twined around like lichen, as the Midrash puts it. That description, that's what happened at midnight. What does that mean? If he had emitted a single curse, klala achat, mehechan hayiti omed, where would I have been? Where would I have come from? It's an extraordinary Midrash. Where would I have come from if Boaz had done the natural, obvious, intuitive thing? Some demonic force grabs you in the middle of the night. You suddenly wake up. The first thing you do, and it says it in every handbook for dealing with demonic forces on granary floors, what you do is you curse. You utter a thorough, you know, full-blooded curse to get rid of that spirit, that demon that's come in endangering your life. What would have happened if he had done the natural, obvious thing? No David, no King David. Where would I be? What happened instead? Natan belibo ubercha. God put it into his heart, and instead he blessed her. And he said to her, brucha at lashem biti. Blessed be you to God, my daughter. That is, not only doesn't he curse her, not only does he control himself, but instead of cursing, he blesses. That is, he does something which is chesed. That is, he responds to her chesed, to her imagination and her courage and her powerful beauty by an act of beauty himself. Where does it come from? Where does that chesed come from? It comes from God. God put it in his heart. Suddenly, unaccountably, he doesn't do the logical thing. He doesn't do the expected thing that any sensible person would do. And instead, strangely, he blesses instead of cursing. What's the effect of that blessing? The life of King David. Now, that story could be told in a much more banal way. We could say simply that the result of that night was King David. However, the Midrash does it in the most powerful possible way by telling the story from King David in his words. In the words of someone who thinks back to the possibility, every child thinks about this possibility. What would have happened if my father and my mother had never met? You know, what would have happened? Every child knows the story about how her parents met. And what the child always speculates, what was the beginning of my life? Without that beginning, where would I be? Would I have had to be? And I suppose there is a sense that of course I would have had to be. In some way or other, I am essential, I am necessary. And then there is that first dawning and uncanny thought. I remember it from childhood, that perhaps I didn't have to be. Perhaps if this and that hadn't happened. And how much hangs on what we call chance? It's not chance. Here, it's not even a question of Boaz and Ruth meeting. It's a much more macroscopic question. It's a question of a curse and a blessing. Something that's said. Something of ugliness, something of beauty. Something that comes from fear and anxiety and horror, which destroys everything. And something that comes from trust and courage and love. Beauty, what I'm calling beauty. On that hangs the life of King David, and he recognizes that himself, almost in a biological sense. He has a sense of his own spiritual biology, where he comes from in every possible sense. Now, what I've been suggesting, and I'd like to add a coda to this, what I've been suggesting is that there is a very real meaning to a book, to a beautiful book, in which the word to see is absent, in which no one looks at each other in that measuring, imperialistic way, what I'm calling a kind of imperialism, a kind of power look, which is the look with which people look at each other even when love is in question, even when there is a question of a loving connection. That is absent from this book. And I think it's particularly important when we think of where this book belongs in the sequence of the biblical books. It belongs historically at the end of the period of the Judges, about which we read again and again in the story of the period of the Judges. What's the leitmotif there? That every man did what was yeshar be'inav. Every man did what was right in his own eyes. That was the period of anarchy, I remember. That was the period of a kind of rapaciousness and power madness. People did exactly what they wanted to do. It all depended on what they saw. Each person did what was right in his own eyes. And then we have a book in which there is no reference to seeing other than finding grace in the eyes of another. The possibility of finding, of creating a presence of beauty precisely by not looking too hard. The Little Prince, of course, is the best textbook for this kind of wisdom. Is that still read? Are people familiar with The Little Prince? Little Prince, of course, who says, what is essential is invisible to the eye. What is essential is invisible to the eye. The coda is a kind of broadening out from this book to very large issues. What does this book come to suggest? What does it come to tell us in the largest possible sense? We said that the book begins with death. And it ends with life. It begins with the death of the three men, and that means the end of the road for the three women. The three women, at the beginning of the story, the three widows are widows without a future. That is clearly, that's built into the situation, and in fact, Naomi says it to Ruth in her speech at the beginning. It ends with the birth of a baby and the baby. It ends with a baby, with what a baby? It begins with mortality. That is not just with the deaths of particular men, but with a sense of mortality, with a heaviness, with a sense of no future. And it ends, and here I want to use a word that Hannah Arendt coined, I think. She coined the word natality. This is in a book called The Human Condition. And she wants to think of a word to correspond to mortality, but at the birth end. And to mean not just the fact of giving birth or being born, but that whole climate that surrounds the idea of birth. The idea of birth means the new beginning. It means hope. It means a certain courageousness, initiative, the miracle which is newness. And this is what she has to say about it. Let me read a sentence or two. She says, natality, which of course has at its root the idea of birth, is the capacity of beginning something new, which is inherent in all human actions. The new always happens against the overwhelming odds of statistical laws and their probability, the certainties. The new, therefore, always appears in the guise of a miracle. With word and deed, we insert ourselves into the human world like a second birth. What's important is not so much the moment in which we are born, but the moment in which we insert ourselves by our words and our deeds, by our blessings, rather than curses, and so forth. We insert ourselves into the world like a second birth. Something is born every time something new happens. Something new morally, spiritually happens. Something is born which has to do with the very identity of a human being. One more sentence from her essay here. This again is possible only because each man is unique, so that with each birth, something uniquely new comes into the world. In a certain sense, nobody was there before. In a certain sense, nobody was there before. In a certain sense, with every birth, something uniquely new comes into the world. Every human being represents that newness and brings that newness into reality, into fruition, with the second birth. That is, with the moral moment in which one does something that is mad. One does something that is not predictable and old and the way people always do things, but one finds the courage and the vision, the other kind of vision, to ignore what is obviously to be seen and to go beyond and to listen to the voices of a different reality. In connection with this idea, I want to finish with an extraordinary passage. For the Hebrew readers, it's in number 6 on your page. This is a passage in a book called Pachad Yitzchak, written by one of the great Jewish philosophers of the 20th century, Rabbi Yitzchak Huttner. He is not generally known because he's not translated, and he's also very dense, very, very rich text. He has a series of books. This is from one of them, from the book on Shavuot. And here he talks about the uniqueness of the human being. And I'd like very briefly to convey to you what he has to say. And I hope that by doing so, we'll see how the theme from Ruth that we've been talking about has very large resonance. He quotes from the Talmud and Sanhedrin, a very famous statement. Every person has to say, is obliged to say, "Bishvili nivra haolam." For me, the world was created. So there's a kind of obligation of narcissism, if you will. This is obligatory narcissism. Every person is obliged to say, "For my sake, the world was created." Well, why? Ki Adam nivra yichidi. Because the first human being was created alone. So the first human being could, plausibly, say, "For me, the world was created." He was set into the Garden of Eden. The whole world was ready for him. And he could say, "I see all this good stuff, all this beauty was there waiting for me to come and inherit the world." From there, we learn that every human being, every Adam, should say, "Bishvili nivra ha'olam." For me, the world was created. However, Rabbi Huttner here really penetrates very deep. He says, basically, for any human being after the first Adam, that is almost impossible to say. How can a person who knows about death, who knows about not only death, but mortality, how can a person say, "For me, the world was created"? Adam could say it before he knew about death. He could really feel that the world is there for him. As soon as God said to Adam, "If you eat of the tree, you will surely die." And he does eat of the tree and doesn't die right away, you remember? It's not that death comes into the world, but mortality comes into the world. At that moment, from that moment onwards, he knows that he is bound for death. There is something within him that is death. There's a poison within him that's there. And how, from that point onwards, how can any person say, "For me, the world was created"? Every person knows that there will come a time after 120 when I will no longer be here, and the world will go on its merry way. It won't be affected in the least, apparently, by my disappearance. For all empirical purposes, it's very difficult, to put it mildly, to say, "For me, the world is created." What can one do about this? So Rabbi Huttner says, either one has to have enormous faith. Right? Either it's a test of enormous faith, such as few people are capable of, the kind of faith that says, "I believe ultimately in life rather than death, and that ultimately death will be defeated. Death, thou shalt die," what does John Donne say? There will be an end to death, and God will wipe the tears off the cheeks, and there will be a forgetting of that nightmare, of that horror that we call death. Either one has to have that kind of very unusual faith, or else what? There is one other resource, he says, that could enable us to say, "Bishvili nivra ha'olam," "For me, the world was created." There is one trace, he calls it a trace, a roshim, just a kind of impression that's left within the empirical world of that singularity and uniqueness of human beings. And we find it where? We find it the ma'or panav shel adam, in the light of the human face. If you look at the face of a human being, any human being, there is a certain radiance. There's a certain, how shall I put it? There's a certain light that comes off the face of a human being, and it's a light of uniqueness. The light on one person's face is not the same as the light on another person's face. People are made individual. That's an item, a dogma, something one believes. No, says Rabbi Huttner, it's not something you believe. It's something you can actually see. You can actually see it, but only, and again, the same irrational truth holds, you can only see it if you don't look too hard. You can only see it if you're not staring too hard at the eyes and the nose and the mouth. That's not where you'll find the individuality. All the noses are the same in a sense, and all the mouths are the same, or they fall into very clearly recognized classes. If that's what you're looking at, then you won't see it. Somewhere, perhaps, one has to listen rather than see. One has to be sensitive to that light. The light, call it the expression. the expression on the face of another person. That expression is unique. There are no two expressions, there are no two faces that have the same expression. If one is sensitive to that, if one is aware of that, then one can simply extrapolate from that. But if the other person has it, then presumably I have it too. Somewhere I can't see myself. I can never see my own, the light of my own face. I can only see the eyes and the nose and the mouth in my own face if I look in the mirror. But I assume that if everybody has it, then I have it too. And therefore, there is a possibility then of coming into contact with that uniqueness, which makes it possible to say, Bishvili Nivra Ha'olam. What that has the power to generate, in fact, of course, is a world. If one is aware of that uniqueness and that singularity of human beings, then what happens when two human beings encounter each other, and this is what we see in the Book of Ruth, is that they begin to register that world-generating uniqueness that each has for the other. And I'm really trying not to be sentimental about this. I'm really not talking about sentimental things. I'm talking about something that I consider to be, it's a form of realism. It's a form of encounter in its truest form between human beings. And it comes, paradoxically, when human beings can, to some extent, forget themselves. They can forget themselves in the encounter with the other. There's a certain kind of forgetting, a certain kind of unawareness of obvious things that allows one to become aware of something that's not obvious, of that great unknown, which is the other. So that really what has to happen, and Freud said it, he said it in many ways, and he regarded, I think, that he regarded the psychoanalytic encounter as a model of this, that there has to be a sense in which the two approach each other, they catch the drift of each other. Somewhere they're not staring at each other, they catch something essential about each other through an act of evenly suspended attention. That's his expression, evenly suspended attention. Not reacting spasmodically to the interesting things the other person says in our normal social way, but rather somewhere suspending that kind of hectic attention, that kind of selfish attention, and allowing a kind of true attention, a true mindfulness to the internal beauty of the other, to the possibility of a relationship that is being held out to one by listening with the truth to what the other has to say. My sense is that the beauty of the Book of Ruth very largely inheres in the beauty that Ruth initiates. And one has to say it, that Ruth is the one who initiates it. And that's what Boaz thanks her for. He thanks her for her courage and for her vision and for her capacity to engage with the dangers of banality, with the dangers of banal interpretations of what is happening between them, in order to create what will eventually be the messianic line. And somewhere there is an understanding between them. Of course, they know nothing about the future. They are not prophets in any sense. And yet what the sages attribute to them is a kind of intuition. There's a kind of profound intuition. And the root of the word intuition in English has to do with looking. It has to do with a certain kind of looking, a looking inwards, intuition. It's a looking inwards. Perhaps in order to achieve that looking inwards, what is needed is a certain effacement, right? Effacement of the external gaze so as to allow that internal gaze to operate with great power and great beauty. Thank you.